Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Berkshire Theatre Group presents an intimate performance with Brian Stokes Mitchell on September 5th at 8 p.m. at the Colonial Theatre in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
You can gripe all you like. You can sneer, where are the heroes? You can shout about how everything's a lie. Then that flag goes by. You can snipe at the greed, at the need to be a winner, at the hype you keep hearing from on high. And you think, why try? And you wanna cry. Then that flag goes by. And you think, that's why. That's the best idea. That's a really good idea. What you wanna do is brag. I'm part of that. Yeah, I know it's just a flag, okay, but still, for a minute you say, hey, we could, we will fix everything tomorrow. For a minute you're aware, you're feeling proud, and then suddenly you're staring at the crowd. And you're thinking, there's no link I can see. They're as different from me as they possibly could be. Then you see the ID.
Stokes is a Tony Award-winning actor whose Broadway credits include Ragtime, Kiss Me Kate, Man of La Mancha, and Shuffle Along. Television credits include Trapper John, M.D., and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, as well as Glee, Mr. Robot, Billions, and The Good Fight, among many others. He is currently serving his 16th term as the chairman of the Board of the Actors Fund and is a co-founder of the Black Theatre United Coalition. Once again, Brian Stokes Mitchell will perform a concert for the Berkshire Theatre Group this Saturday, September 5th at 8 p.m., and we welcome him back to the Roundtable this morning. Stokes, welcome back to the Roundtable.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be with you.
I'm so happy to speak with you. I do want to start by asking you, you were diagnosed with COVID. You did have it during this horrible and stressful and dreadful time for everybody. You were subjected to the illness. What are you willing to share with us about your experience?
Oh, whatever you want to know. There's no secrets in anyone's life anymore, right?
Right.
Internet and everything else. So, and I've talked about this as well. You know, actually, I purposefully, when I first got it, I just started going online about it because I actually had it. It was late February, early March, and it was still very mysterious. A lot of people were concerned about, will I get it? What happens if I get it? What does it feel like? How will I know if I have it? Will I die from it? You know, what are the symptoms? What will it feel like? So I thought, I'll just go online and talk about it and kind of demystify the disease. I kind of got it as bad as you can get it without winding up in the hospital, thanks to my wife and son took great care of me and Dr. Jason Kint with the Actors Fund. Actually, he was online with me, you know, constantly on the phone and talking me through it. Like, you know, most fortunate people that get it, I passed through it and got to the other side, which is really, really great. But I had the worst body aches, worst muscle aches, worst chills, worst fever, went up to 104.8 that I've ever had before. And that's how you know if you have COVID, you know, if you get those kind of symptoms, it doesn't feel like anything else you've ever had. But now I'm here to, and I live to tell the tale.
And we're very grateful for that. When you got tested, did you think you just maybe had the flu or a cold, or were you sure that it was something more serious because of the severity of the symptoms?
I wasn't sure. I was actually working on a show at the time called Love Life at City Center Encores, which got canceled about 4 days before it was supposed to open. And nobody knew, you know, what was going on. And I had what felt like a sinus infection at the time, which might have been a sinus infection as well. And then COVID happened somewhere else. So I got that in some other way. That's kind of what started for me. But then I remember one particular night, I just had this really terrible fever and my body aches, and I had terrible chills, and I couldn't get warm enough, even though I had a temperature at that point is probably 102 or 103. And so I knew something was up, and I had gotten tested, but then it took about 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 days to get the results back. So I didn't know. And by the time I got the results back, I was over most of the symptoms of it. But I remember telling the doctor, I said, I'll be a little pissed if I don't have COVID, because if this isn't COVID, I don't want to know what COVID is.
Right.
COVID, as it turned out, it was. So
some people are now concerned, now that, you know, a number of people have come through it, of course, across the country and especially in New York, that there might be lasting effects that they aren't sure of yet, just because the timeline ultimately has been so short. Do you feel completely up to snuff, back to full capacity?
Yeah, it did take a while, though, probably in the last maybe 3 months. I think for 3 months, though, I felt, you know, I would get tired, you mm-hmm. know, more than usual, and just think, oh, I need to lay down and have a nap or something, you know. I feel little other twinges. Actually, when I had it, I could actually feel it. I had a sense of it moving throughout my body.
Mm-hmm.
I remember early on, in it, I got really bad backaches, but it wasn't like a usual backache, and it wasn't in my bones. And I thought, I think that's my kidneys, actually, that are hurting. And then I could feel it in other areas of my body, and it started at the very last part of it, trying to get into my lungs. But by then, I think I had my body was starting to fight it off, so it didn't have a lasting effect that way. About 3 months ago, if I took a deep breath, I could still feel a little something there, you know, like it felt like I couldn't get a full breath. But I just started jogging and running and exercising, and it seemed to scare the rest of it out, you know, or whatever that was. It probably was just a weakening of my lungs.
You mentioned a few moments ago the Actors Fund. You're the chairman of the board for the Actors Fund. What does that organization and holding that position mean to you?
Oh, it's like it means everything, actually. I just feel so honored to be a part of it. The organization's been around for 138 years now, and it feels like what we're going through now as a country and as a world, really, with COVID and all the other things that are going on, but particularly with COVID, it feels like those last 138 years have been a kind of really great dress rehearsal or previews for where we are now, because it's kind of placed us in this wonderful position to be able to help people out. And the Actors Fund is not just for actors. It's for anybody who's made their living in show business or the performing arts, you know, camera operators, writers, directors, radio personalities, anybody in times of need or crisis or transition can get the help from the Actors Fund. Generally, we have a lot of different programs, but one of the things I just want to mention is our Emergency Assistance Fund. Generally, in a year, we'll give out about $2 million to the Emergency Assistance Fund. That goes to people with the most critical needs, paying for the rent, paying for prescriptions, paying for insurance, you know, the things that they need the most. This year, we've given out over $15 million
wow.
to more than 12,000 people now. So you can really see what dire straits the television and film and stage industries have been in. We were like the first to go down and will likely be the last sector to come back as well.
It does seem unimaginable how long we haven't had a show on Broadway first, but also that, like, sports is coming back. I would have hoped that they would, you know, be equal and gone as long as each other, or both back as soon as
yes.
possible is a better way to put that. Do you think it's the money in sports that made the sports come back faster? Or just that they can do it without an audience, without a crowd?
I think they can do it without an audience.
Right.
That really is the thing, you know, because you can televise it. And of course, it's about the players, and you keep hearing about certain things getting shut down, or they start up and then something happens. Players find out they get infected and they're not able to do it or have games. But really, it's all which is important, because those are the people having contact. Actors, however, also have contact, but we sing, you know, with each other. So we're constantly spitting on each other, kissing each other, hugging each other. And, you know, and that's just on stage. On stage it happens as well. So it's a close contact sport, acting is. And then, of course, especially if you're on Broadway or in the live theater, it demands people to be sitting with each other, because it really is about storytelling. And I liken it to, you know, sitting around the campfires. There's this primal need for people to hear stories being told together about themselves, and sharing that with other people as they're hearing these stories. And that's really what the theater gives you. And because it's different every time you see it, unlike a film, which is a different kind of storytelling. But no matter where you sit in theater when you're watching a film or in front of your television, it's always the exact same thing. And because it's in two dimensions, everybody's seeing the exact same picture. Because the theater's in three dimensions, depending on where you're sitting in the audience, you're getting a different point of view of it. So nobody sees the same thing. And because it's live, every show is different. So you are the one audience member experiencing a live show from that point of view in all of time that will have that experience. And that's one of the things I think that makes it special.
This is a silly question, but one I ask with sincere curiosity. Since this started, I've been hearing a lot about actors spitting on each other while singing and talking on stage, which, of course, I've witnessed. I know that they do. But how do you get used to that as a performer? And I'm sure that none of you hold it against each other. It's just part of the projection and the job.
No, that's a great question, actually. Nobody's ever asked me that one, so I kind of like the fact that you asked that. You know, one of the things is, you know, sometimes you get spit on, and I think a lot of actors secretly wish that they hope that, you know, when they get cast in something, oh, I hope my co-star is not a spitter, or whoever I'm working with, you know. But you know that it's part of the thing too. I've worked with people that spit a lot, you know, when they sing. But also generally in the theater, when people sing, they're faced front.
Yeah,
they're not so much,
or at least three quarters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So you generally don't get spit on, but if you have a big, you know, operatic, you know, huge kind of aria kind of thing that you're singing with the other person, oh, you'll get spit on. So, but it's interesting because that's one of the things that they've started to do now that's happening in the Berkshires, as a matter of fact. And I just did my first live concert in Michigan as well about a week and a half ago at another theater. But they close off the first three or four rows. So the first audience member is, depending on the setup of the theater, is quite a long ways away from you because, you know, they have the usual 6-foot social distancing for civilians, you know, in our normal life. But they, I guess, have been able to figure out that when somebody's singing or shouting or yelling or speaking loudly like actors do on a stage, that the spittle can go much farther than the 6 feet. So that's one of the precautions they've been taking.
You have recently co-founded the Black Theater United Coalition with a mission of fighting racism in the theater community. What are some of the first steps the coalition is taking?
Well, we have a number of things that we do. We kind of like to work on a macro level and a micro level as well. We've been in discussions with a lot of theaters and folks about, because there's been a lot of concerns about what do we do now? How do we get going? Because this systemic racism that's everywhere in our country is in our theaters as well. What's great is we've been approached by a number of different producers and organizations that are saying, okay, we know we have a problem here and we know we need to fix this. What can we do to help? How can you help us? So that's one of the things that we do. We're also working on a macro level, we like to call it. We're partnering right now with Stacey Abrams and A Fair Count because we're trying to get word out about the census, which is incredibly important. It was extended to October 31st, then pulled back to September 31st because I think some people thought, oh, we don't want it to be quite that level or that fair because of COVID. Normally, it would have ended July 31st. But the census is so important. A lot of people really don't understand what it is. It defines where about $1.8 trillion a year are going. And when you say, I'm here, basically, that means that you're going to be counted. And it defines, like, for instance, what monies go to different communities that pertain to education, to infrastructure. It's likely that whenever we get a vaccine for COVID, that the census is going to define where that vaccine goes first. That might very well be a part of that. It also has to do with voting and prevents a lot of gerrymandering because a lot of people say, oh, there's nobody here. But people are scared away from it. And dirty tricks are often used, you know, saying, well, if you do that, they're going to come and arrest you, you know, and they don't ask any questions about immigration status, its citizenship or anything like that. And what's used in the census can only be used by the census. It's not shared with anybody else. But what it will do is allow certain money to go to your community. So if you're counted, especially the black and brown communities have been grossly undercounted throughout the history of the census. And that's why it's especially important to have people just send in the form. It only takes about 10 minutes to do it. If it's still sitting around your house, fill it out, send it in. You can go online as well to, I think, census.gov. Do the same thing there. And then call five people of your friends, family members, see if they've sent it, and make sure they sent it out and ask them to do the same. But everybody really needs to do that. It's very, very important to get money to your community.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, then the macro and the micro means the Black Theater United Coalition is working to fight the systemic racism as a whole in the country, possibly the world, and then also working in theaters to make sure that diversity is represented properly in theater productions
nicely.
When they come back.
Yes, nicely put, actually. That's exactly what we're doing, because we realize, you know, there's so many more problems than what's happening in the theater, and we have a lot of influence because of the people that are involved in the organization on social media and just people that listen to us. We really wanted to make the best use of our kind of celebrity, our status, mm-hmm. our you know, what we've been given, and try to make the world better. And there's so many people that are just reaching out right now saying, what can we do? How can we help? So, you know, anybody can join as a member or an ally at blacktheaterunited.com as well. So all are welcome.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, to right the unrightable wrong, to love pure and chaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. This is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the rights without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest.
You, of course, as you know, we're in the Men of La Mancha on Broadway, and I imagine once you sing Impossible Dream on stage, you are expected to sing it nearly every time you take the stage, unless you're performing in a different role. But you also performed it for your neighbors during this time of COVID-19. Did it gain a new fullness? Was that a special performance for you?
Yeah, it was, and I wasn't expecting that to happen, because as most people know, at 7 o'clock every night for about 2 months, New Yorkers would open up the windows and clap, cheer, bang on pots and pans, do whatever, as thanks to all the essential workers that were still working through, you know, this time when all of us were isolated and very afraid and still trying to figure what COVID was all about. And those essential workers not only include the fire department and the doctors and the nurses and the police department, it also includes people that work at the grocery store and people that were delivering food to people. Sometimes people don't think about that. So I was actually still battling COVID, and I would go to the window and clap. And one of the ways that I kind of check out the power of my lungs. I would just sing. And one day I was at the window and I thought, I think I can sing without coughing now. And so I sang part of The Impossible Dream out the window, and everybody stopped on the street. And the people that were there just cheered and whooped and hollered after, because I did it after the applause died down for the essential workers, because it was an act of gratitude for them and for my doctor, Jason Kint, you know, and all of the other people that were going through it. So the next day when I went to the window, I wasn't planning on singing again. And then somebody yelled out, "Sing the song." And so I sang the song again. And then I noticed the crowd started getting bigger and bigger. And finally, it got to a point where there were hundreds of people on the street. And at this point, news people from all over the world started coming and doing interviews with me. And it went viral, and pun intended, I guess. Mm. It was quite remarkable. But I was mostly moved by the desire, I think, for people to have this kind of, like I was saying, this live theater experience of the shared experience we were going through, and for everybody to have this moment where they could sit and listen to this song that's incredibly inspirational, and get get kind of reconnected. Some neighbors, you know, would come up to me and say, that's the only joy that I have during my day. I come out every night now and listen to you sing, you know, and I bring my family with me and they all love it. And I kept hearing messages like that back. And I really wasn't thinking about just the, you know, everyday folks outside of the essential workers. But I realized, oh, this is really an important thing to connect people to this. So I felt very honored, actually, that I was kind of able to play that role. And still almost every day somebody mentions it to me, or they stop me on the street, or somebody sees me. And it was just a nice way also to kind of bring the neighborhood together. I had to break it up because it got too crowded on the street. And so many people were showing up and the cops were getting worried. And sometimes the cops would pull up and literally stop the traffic while I sang, which was really, really terrific. Because they noticed that people weren't paying attention to the traffic, and it's on Broadway, you know, which is a very, very busy street. And so one day after one of the interviews that I did, I saw one of the NYPD policemen parked on, you know, and I said, "Hey, I'm the guy that sings for the movie." He said, "Oh, you're the guy." Mm-hmm. I said, "Yeah." I said, I'm just getting a little concerned about, you know, the traffic here and the people that are showing up. "Yeah, yeah, so are we. I actually came to break this up. My boss told me I needed to break it up." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, because mostly people aren't social distancing anymore when it happens. So we're concerned about that as well." You know, I said, "Well, no, I'm doing this to honor you guys. What will make your, you know, life easier? You know, is there something that I could do?" He said, "Stop singing from the window." Well, actually, that was the same day that I was thinking I'm going to stop singing, because I remember looking down and just at all the people and seeing, you know, what happens when I started singing, and people would just be focused on me and crossing the street and not looking at the traffic. And I thought, oh, I'm really concerned that somebody's going to get hit. So that for me was my confirmation. Yeah, I need to stop doing this. But later I actually went to some hospitals and sang at 7 o'clock for the workers that would come out, the doctors and nurses that would come out at 7 o'clock. And so I sang for them there at the hospital. I took my act on the road, and that was a nice thing to do.
You are taking your act on the road to the Berkshires this Saturday. You'll be performing a concert entitled An Intimate Performance with Brian Stokes Mitchell this Saturday in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, presented by the Berkshire Theater Group. To learn more, berkshiretheatergroup.org. We'll post that link along with links to learn more about the Actors Fund and the Black Theater United Coalition along with this interview on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Brian Stokes Mitchell, thank you so, so much for your time and for your voice. I appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you, and continued health and safety to you and to all of your listeners as well. And let's continue to love one another.
And the world will be better for this. That one man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage to reach.
listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.